Gerard Burke, age 61, at 129 Old Bedford Road, is being interviewed by Renee Garalick for Concord's Oral History Program. The interview is taking place on May 31st, 2005. Under Article 32, the Town of Concord, at their annual town meeting this year, voted to purchase the Burke land, 14.4 acres of farmland on Old Bedford Road. By buying the property now, before it is offered for sale on the open market, the town explained that it is buying time to prepare a plan to identify a source of long-term funding for its acquisition that does not depend on the property tax. The purchase price of $2.5 million and the cost of short-term borrowing for 1 year of $60,000 would be paid from an existing line item in the budget. Any permanent financing plan would be brought before the 2006 annual town meeting for approval. If no plan is able to be developed, the article authorized the selectmen to sell the property. There are multi-uses that the town certainly has in mind that they see purchasing the Burke land as an opportunity. What multi-use possibilities does the land offer to the town?
Well, I would say probably that the family's dream would be that as much as possible continue to be open and continue to be used as agricultural land as it has been for so many years. We have an interest primarily in open land. My conversations with the town have sort of like opened a couple of other directions. One of them is because we are contiguous with the Ripley School property. There has been from the outset of my conversations with the town the likelihood that at least some of the property toward the west would be sort of added to the school's campus to give them more flexibility at Ripley. How far forward that might come, I don't know. You know, I've asked them to the extent that the school committee or you know, Ripley reaches the point where it's using much of the property, that they try to keep the property closer to the road as open as it is right now. So fields would be fine, but I'd hate to see buildings smack against the road. That's not what I'm hoping. The other potential use is that there have been sort of three-way conversations going on with the Concord Housing Trust about the possibility of using the free space behind my father's home at 129 expand the diversity of the housing stock in Concord. And so moderate income housing is a possibility for that piece, and to the extent that would require the use of a strip of land to the south of my father's house, that would make sense as well.
So you would add that strip into?
Well, I mean, I think that it becomes a question. That's really the town's decision once they've acquired it. But I know that one of the conversations has involved, in terms of multi-use, has involved using a narrow strip to gain access to the piece behind without disturbing too much of the landscaping and the way the land is now. Mm-hmm. You know, farmland doesn't have trees on it. And so what you try to do is, if you want to say what trees you've got.
Mm-hmm. And the actual 129 Old Bedford Road house stays.
I think that would be Yes, I would think that would be the plan, yeah.
Okay. Can you begin to talk about your family from the very beginning?
Mm-hmm. Well, some of the dates I have pretty clearly and others I don't. My grandfather, Thomas Burke, there was Thomas J. Burke and a Thomas J. Burke Jr. and then another Jr., which complicates things for me. But anyway, the original Thomas J. Burke arrived in this area around 1861.
Now, he's your...
Great-great-grandfather.
Your great-grandfather?
Oh,
probably.
Dear.
Okay.
Great-grandfather.
Okay.
And by 1871, he and his wife, who had arrived, you know, in the mid-1860s,
from
Ireland. Everybody's from Ireland. Everybody's from Ireland on both sides of my family. Anyway, her name was Burns, and Rose Burns. And they arrived from, and by 1871, they purchased from one of the Merriam family members, and somewhere I have a record of his first name, the Merriam house and 50 plus acres around it. It's interesting because although I can't find all the papers nowadays, at one point I saw one of the original deeds, and with it there was an indication that there had been a mortgage, and so a Mr. Sawyer, S-O-H-I-E-R, which I think is still a name in town, apparently loaned my grandfather some of the money to purchase the land. So I've often speculated that my grandfather may have worked for the Sawyers, but I think it's interesting that you know, one of the locals was willing to support my grandfather in his efforts to gain, you know, a foothold here in town.
Your great-grandfather.
My great-grandfather.
Yeah.
Goodness.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then we'll come to the next. He was a farmer, obviously.
He was a farmer, yes. And one of his sons, Thomas Jr., married my grandmother, Ellen Teresa D. Ellen was one of three kids who was being raised by her father, and that was John D., I think, and...
part of the big D family?
Oh, very much a part of the D family. I am related to so many people in town that I'm constantly stumbling mm-hmm. on the connections. Anyway, their family lived in what was the Hartwell Farm on Virginia Road in Lincoln. The house was a restaurant for a number of years. My parents had their wedding reception there. And burned down, actually, after the National Park acquired it. And so there now there's the frame of a house and a fascinating chimney with nooks and crannies, and the chimney work is wonderful. But so anyway, the D's were there. There were three D children. There were two girls and a boy. Thomas D. Wound up marrying Helena Lennon, whose name everybody called her Toppy, T-O-P-P-I-E. She actually did some writing of history herself, and having grown up around Lincoln and so forth and so on. And they lived on Tower Road in Lincoln for many years, never had any children. He died in Christmas, I think, of 49 or 50, and she survived him by 30 years. And then the other sister was Mary Aljo, and she lived right across the street from the Hartwell house, married Mr. Aljo, and there were several children there. One was Leo Aljo, who actually lives in Stowe now, but would be a fascinating person to interview. Leo was police chief in Lincoln for many years mm-hmm. and has lots of interesting memories. And
so your grandparents lived in which house?
My grandparents. They were first of all, they were married, I guess it was Christmas Eve or New Year's Eve in 1903. And there was a house which was being built across the street from the Merriam house, which is now 55 Old Bedford Road, in which the Park Service now owns. And that house was being built for them. They weren't able to move in until the spring. The house was not finished. I'm often sort of amused because the National Park Service has been forced they weren't first, but they chose to replace the stone wall that was around the front yard of the Merriams. And the original stone wall wound up in the foundation of a small barn across the street from the Merriam house, which is not there anymore, but most of the stone wall wound up in the stone foundation of 55 Old Bedford Road. So if they ever wanted to restore the original wall, the house would have to come down. And they had six children.
What color is the house now?
The house is brown now. I can remember it having been green.
Mm-hmm.
It's always tended to be sort of in fairly dark colors. But I can remember that house over my entire life. It was sort of like one of the places that I always went back to. I spent time with my grandmother and my father's sisters and brother there. And it's a house that has a lot of really good memories. It always sort of felt very much like a home away from home for us.
The Thoreau Society, are they using that?
The Thoreau Society, yes, has been leasing it for a while, and I guess they're going to be there until they're able to move into the Thoreau House, which was the Breen House, I guess, which is over on Virginia Road.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I've gone over several different times and chatted with Jane, who's the current executive director of the Thoreau Society, and it's great fun to wander through the house today. I had always imagined that a lot of changes had been made, but there haven't been many changes. As a matter of fact, you still have to walk upstairs to go to the bathroom.
Okay, and then from your grandparents?
It's one other thing that sort of occurs to me about that house, I realize, is I've been told that it was built right around 1900 and was one of the first 20 or 30 houses in the area that actually had telephones. And so neighbors would come to my grandparents' house to use the phone to get in touch with other people until it reached the point where more people had phones. And I'm sorry, so the...
First of all, was your grandfather a farmer as well?
Oh yes, my grandfather, like his father before him, was a farmer. And farmed land. And by the teens, 20s, and I'm not sure how late it went on, but the Burkes were one of many farms in the neighborhood that sort of made Concord's reputation for Concord grass. There were asparagus beds, I gather, everywhere. And when the season would come around, my aunts and uncles would talk about these men who sort of came from nowhere, or presumably came sort of on a migrant worker circuit, and would come and work for the length of the season, which was several weeks. So there'd be half a dozen or more of them. During the time that we were there, or they were, there cutting the asparagus and so forth and so on, my grandmother would cook for them as well as the family. So that would have been eight in the family and another six or eight people, say, camped out and being fed. And the family had fascinating stories about some of these men. Fiddlers, and I also suspect that to some extent they sort of invented exotic histories for some of these men who sort of like came along and were here for 6 months or 6 weeks and then went somewhere else. And one of them played the squeeze box accordion, and another played the fiddle, and they were just fascinating people. And I think that aunts especially sort of speculated about why it was that these men were apparently kind of ruthless. I think that making up stories about them probably was a pastime.
This was a very Irish area, the East Quarter.
It was a very Irish area. And even when I was growing up in the 40s and 50s, there was this circle which the McHughes were always at the core of everything. I mean, we have this small collection of fascinating bachelors and two unmarried sisters at home, and they weren't distracted by children, I think, and so they managed to continue to be sort of like storytellers and singers and
minstrel
shows, and they were just involved in Knights of Columbus and very much involved in the church and so forth. I remember Maras and Daltons and McGurns and McGuires I'm sure I'll wind up leaving someone out, but there was this gang of people that were, you know, right up close and part of the clan, and I used to think that it was going to wind up that all of these people had sort of like moved from very much the same place in Ireland and sort of transplanted a village, which actually tended to happen with the Italians in the North End in Boston later, but these people were from all over Ireland. You could sit down a group of them and you'd get people from Donegal and Galway and Waterford and Meath and places all over Ireland. But here they had their Irishness in common, and they had their Catholicism in common. And then after the turn of the century, the wave of Italian immigrants started arriving, who had in common with the Irish their Catholicism. But it's clear from having listened to the stories that it wasn't always a terribly easy blend right at the very beginning. There were peoples of very different temperaments. Mm. And of course, the Irish at least shared a language with the people that were already here in most cases.
Within your father's generation, mm-hmm. Who were the people within the family? Your father's name was?
Gerard. Mm-hmm. He was the youngest. The oldest was Catherine. She always made a point of it was C-A-T-H-A-R-I-N-E, which is a slightly different spelling of Catherine, and fortunately Catherine Hepburn came along with the same spelling and gave her some justification for that spelling. And then there was a brother, Jack. John H. And John died in 1937, and he worked for the town tree department and was killed in a fall in West Concord. And then two sisters, Alice Hargrove, and she ultimately owned the home at 82 Old Bedford Road. She built that in the 60s. She and her husband became from Lexington. And her younger sister, Nancy, her real name was Anne Winifred, but she didn't want anybody to know that. She worked for 30 years or more at the what was called the Reformatory, Mass Correctional Institution, Concord. First as a clerk in the steward's office and ultimately as treasurer of the prison. She married Leo O'Malley, who was one of the correction officers there, and they lived in Littleton until, well, he died about 15 years ago, and she died in 1992. My Uncle Tom was the farmer, Thomas J. Burke Jr., and he was the one that carried farming into that generation. He farmed this land right up until the late 60s. He was still... It's been the late 60s because I can remember coming home from college in the early 60s and bringing along a couple of friends from the dormitory, and we would go out and we would plant corn and so forth and so on. And then there was my father, who was in the service. He'd gone to the University of Maine. Graduated in 1940, was actually had gone through the ROTC program and had actually been commissioned an officer and was on active duty at the time that the Second World War broke out, and then spent about 20 years in the service. We would keep coming back here, but we were all different places. So does that cover everybody? Catherine, the eldest, actually stayed at home. She cooked for the entire family. It was sort of a house with two mothers. My grandmother lived until 1963.
Ellen.
And she was an extraordinary lady. She put up with incredible adversity over the years, and seemed never to be particularly down. She always was an optimist. I think that she supplied an awful lot of momentum and, you know, willingness to sort of go back to work at anything all the time. That's sort of where the power was, I still think, was with my grandmother.
Now, Alice came to actually the house that we're doing.
Yes, that's how we're interviewing.
Because of the Park Service.
Largely because of the Park Service, or a confluence of other interests. Alice had been the first one in the family to go off for higher education. She graduated from the two-year normal program at what's now Fitchburg State College, taught for 20 years before marriage, substituted for 20 years, you know, after her marriage. She and her husband, John Hargrove, had moved into to a small little bungalow, cape, which they built next door to his parents' home on Massachusetts Avenue. They were at 3038 Massachusetts Avenue, and her grandmother, or rather her parents-in-law, were at 3058.
In Lexington.
In Lexington, yeah, right opposite what used to be the main entrance to the main road off Mass Ave that led into the airport. And they built there in 1950, when they were married. And over the course of the 50s and early 60s, there was more and more talk about the National Historic Park being established and so forth and so on. My aunt and the others, I think, all had some expectations that this would disrupt their lives. I have a collection of letters that my aunt wrote to Leverett Stahl and John Kennedy, who were senators at the time, and to the representative, whose name I don't recall right now, you know, urging that the National Park Service pass that whole legislation not be enacted. I don't think it was really a surprise to her in the mid-60s when, once the law was enacted, that the park was more and more interested in acquiring land. And they wanted the property that she and her mother-in-law's house was on. And they ultimately acquired it, the Hargrove family home, as it was torn down. And she actually had her house lifted and moved down Massachusetts Avenue and Old Bedford Road and put on the lot, which is now 96, and that house was torn down just last year to make room for a growing family who needed a larger home.
By her son?
No, actually, they're not related. Her sister-in-law, I mean, the house was moved, and her sister-in-law moved in that house. Her sister-in-law had taught for years and years in Belmont. Her name was Florence, and she was a single lady, and when the house was sold, she had a niece and nephew on the other side of the family who gained title to the property, and they sold it to Drew Pierce, and we call her Tamley. I think her name is Tamley. But anyway, they've been there since 1996. They're wonderful neighbors. They they seem to share our love of the land and the views and sort of being there. And when they realized that they simply weren't going to be able to manage with the small house that they bought, they decided that what was really important to them was to stay there. And so they built something larger, which works better for them.
So they are not related?
They're not really related,
okay.
No.
Okay. Now, Alice then built this house.
The irony, one of several ironies, but one of the ironies was that that John, Alice's husband, and she, and I think Florence, John's sister, who was still living on the property, they'd farmed, his father had farmed, and I think it was always their sense that they had a number of acres of land, and that if the town, if the park took the Battle Road property, which was the piece that sort of ran, I don't know how many yards on either side of Massachusetts Avenue, they could simply move farther south. They could back up, you know, into what had been the farm fields back from the road. And
You're talking about what town?
I'm talking now still in Lexington.
Yeah, okay.
That they felt that they could move onto other family land and give up the frontage on Massachusetts Avenue. And ironically, it was about then that the, I guess, it would, I don't know whether it was the State Department of Education or what it was, but anyway, the much of the land on which the Minuteman Technical High School was ultimately built was also on Harbor Oak land. So they were sort of, they had land, taken from them because of the Park Service, and then their plan B evaporated when the state came along and said, oh no, we want the rest of the land. So that was when my aunt decided that they would build themselves a larger house, sort of similar layout, but on a larger scale to the one that they lived in for some years, and that they would move the smaller house here for his sister.
And what year did they come here about?
My parents' house was finished in 1962. I think she finished the move here in 1966 or 1967. And I actually need to look at, I would have to look at the deeds to just sort of see when the property passed. That's probably the best thing. It always...
So probably it was late...
I think it was 66.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it was 66.
Okay. And the number of this house is...
This is 82.
82. Okay.
82, and her old house was numbered 96.
Mm-hmm. The relationship with the Park Service has been a contentious one.
Hmm.
Even though they didn't exercise the right of eminent domain, it was always threatening.
It was always there as a threat. I mean, one always knew that you weren't going to be free to pass it along in the family forever because there were these constraints on it. You knew that you couldn't sell it on the open market because the likelihood that someone would want to buy it on the open market with that same threat lying them would affect the value. So there was this certain irony. I mean, all of these arrangements and is centered around what they call fair market value, which is defined under the law as what a willing buyer would pay a willing seller. And I think two things happen. First of all, I think that none of these things take into account the fact that you oftentimes don't have a willing seller, you know. I mean, if someone were to come along and say, you know, we've determined that the brooch that, you know, your mother has been wearing for 50 years, which she got from her grandmother, you know, is a national treasure, and took it to a jeweler and discovered that it had a value of $350 and say, well, we'll give you $350 because that's the fair market value, doesn't take into account the history and the value and the sentiment that it has for whoever's wearing it. And I think that, you know, the law just doesn't take into account the way people bond with land and with houses. It's just that we, you know, so many of us really cling to the land that we're living on. It's a major piece of security. It's a major piece of the family's history. And so that doesn't get factored into the value. So there's always this sense that there's this risk that something is going to be taken away from you. And this struggle about the fact that, you know, the value thing is there. They're buying land which is actually somewhat unique, you know, and the value that gets placed on it is the value that would be put on it even were it not unique. So people don't get compensated for the uniqueness of the property that they buy. And so it is really a contentious type of situation, and there are certainly, you know, I think that our family, and I know my Aunt Alice especially, you know, had an awful lot of emotional distress because of that. And there are other families, too, that have been really distressed by that.
Did you, when I say you, I mean family.
Yeah.
Did they sell here to the Park Service any land?
Yeah. Yes, they did. In 1969, the five siblings that were alive sold two parcels of land to the Park Service. One was a parcel that ran along Old Bedford Road and then Old Bedford Road, and on the easterly side of Old Bedford Road, the land fanned over and actually abutted Lexington Road as well. So that originally the property where the Willow Pond Kitchen was ultimately situated was part of that property. The Palumbo House, of course, which was a schoolhouse, was carved out of it at some stage of the game. And then there was a piece of property of about an acre between the Willow Pond Kitchen and between the Palumbo House and the Merriam House, which we had farmed. And so that block of property, and then fanning out to what is basically called Mills Brook, which is this small brook that runs across Old Bedford Road. So that property between Lexington Road and Mills Brook was sold to the park. And
is that where the Gowing Swamp is?
No, actually, no. The Gowing Swamp is out to the it's to the west. Gowing
okay.
Swamp is sort of tucked in behind the Catholic cemetery, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so there was 6 acres of land sold there, and then the hillside, which was also part of the property, which is basically the this end of the ridge. They call it Revolutionary Ridge, and it comes up behind Merriam Close and you know, the condo development there, and right to the end. And so they owned that, and so that part of it, which was all woodlot really, and that was another like 3 acres. And that was sold to the Park Service in 1969. Then, in the late 60s, after my grandmother had died, the rest of the siblings got together and they deeded the family homestead at 55 Old Bedford Road to my Aunt Catherine, who was the only one still living there at the time, and all the rest were married and elsewhere. And in 1974, she sold a remainder interest. She kept a life estate so that she had a right of she had a right to live in the property during her lifetime, and the property vested in the National Park Service on her death, which was in 1989.
So that's 55 Old Bedford Road.
That's 55 Old Bedford Road.
Okay.
And that contained, that included about 3 acres.
Now, there was also land, for example, the Merriam House itself was sold in 1951 to
James and Margaret Ingraham, who were a fascinating couple.
I met them.
Yeah, they were. I don't know whether or not you were able to do an interview with them or not. But they, both of them were fascinated by antiques, and so the house was filled with just an incredible collection of colonial and early American stuff. He was from Camden, Maine, and she was from one of the Carolinas. They'd met while he was at West Point, and they moved here from Newton because they wanted more room, and I think they wanted more room for antiques. And so they had that house from 62, I can't remember when she died, and he died in the early 90s. He remarried and moved to Maine. And he too, as I recall, sold the property with a life estate. That actually became, you know, one of the fairly typical moves that the Park Service would offer families. And I think that there are, I don't know how many there are now, but I'm sure that on Massachusetts Avenue there are at least a few more houses which continue to stay in families until, you know, through the measure of someone's life.
And that's true of the Palumbo.
It is true of the Palumbos. I think that the person that's probably has continued to resist and resist, and my bet is that they've not really struck any deal with them all, are the Inferreras, and then the gentleman that owns right next to the Inferreras. They continue to fight and struggle. At the northern edge of the farm, back from the road, the family also sold probably about an acre and a half, I can't remember how many acres, of land to the Heritage Pool and Racquet Club, who wanted to put up a private pool on the property. And so that my recollection is they bought some land from us and some land from the Dolphin family. And they're still there. So they're one of our abutters, if you will.
Incidentally, there is an old cart path that dates back to the 1600s.
Yes.
You want to?
I would love to, because the cart path is really it's played interesting parts even in recent town history. The cart path, although it's not developed, not paved, has the status of a public way, It exists with the town maintaining the rights of all the citizens to pass over.
You want to describe where it is?
Certainly. I can try to describe where it is. It actually runs from just opposite the driveway behind the Merriam House to the left of the shed garage that my grandmother's house, which is falling down now, out basically along the base of the back of the ridge, so that it has hillside to the left and woodlot and farmland to the right. And it runs all the way over, again, just to the south of the Ripley School area, past Gowing Swamp on the left, past our farmlands on the right, and ultimately it winds up in a fairly wet kind of boggy area, which was along by Bedford Street. And in my youth, it always basically sort of like took a left-hand turn and then cut up one side or the other of the Catholic cemetery, and I can't now remember which side of the Catholic cemetery it is. At this stage of the game, it almost doesn't go anywhere because mm-hmm. you can't quite figure out where it would have exited to Bedford Street. Historically, and I think that it's been speculated on often enough so that it's sort of been accepted as fact that when the British left Old North Bridge and the center of Concord and began to head back toward Boston, that they went down the Battle Road, which was Lexington Road, and then Massachusetts Avenue when it crossed the Lexington town line, Lincoln town line. And that the colonials basically came north of the ridge and came down and met them at the end of the ridge, so that the speculation has been that the path of the colonials would have been along this cart path, which is still there. In more recent history, the most recent of the houses which were built on the cart path, if you will, which is now numbered 49 Old Bedford Road, there was quite some struggle about whether or not the Board of Appeals was going to see that as a proper lot in terms of whether or not it had frontage for purposes of building. And at that time, Tom LeBlanc, who owns the property now with his wife, and who was looking to build the property, used the long-term existence of the cart path as a public way to justify placing a house lot and building facing it.
Was that recently?
10 years ago, I guess. Okay. Yeah, so I'm trying to remember how long ago
recent.
It was.
Yeah. And then the Sudbury Valley trustees mm-hmm. owned some of that, right?
Yes, beyond the LeBlanc property, sort of tucked in behind the land that belongs to the Catholic cemetery, and it actually goes through from the cart path, and it abuts the back of the Merriam Close property and the back of Paul Dale's land. It basically bakes up, it backs up to some properties that front on Lexington Road again. And Gowing's Swamp was an area that was one of Thoreau's minor haunts. It's really kind of an interesting area. There's a quaking bog back there, so that it actually at times of the year will support somebody standing on it, but it vibrates, and so it's sort of like a geologic version of a waterbed, if you will. It quivers, I can remember having my father walk me through that area a number of different times. The spring is a good time to look because you'll see trillium and you'll see ladies' slippers and Jack in the Pulpit and lots of sort of not that common wildflowers which, you know, grow in marshy areas. And of course there are legends about people having thrown dead animals in there and so it's sort of a spooky.
Tell me about the crops in addition to asparagus that were grown here.
Well, by the time I was around, the asparagus that was grown was mostly just a bed for the family's use, because I remember eating lots and lots of asparagus in the spring. It would find its way into every meal of the day, but by the time that I remember being on the farm, I sort of thought of the crops in terms of you know, what came first in the year. We were out there working before there was any crop at all, but the first thing that would come in would be the strawberries, and so that was sort of a sign of spring or summer. Throughout the rest of the year, my uncle would use, two or three teenage high school boys, throughout the course of the summer for work, but the strawberry season was different because we'd have a co-ed group. And so I can remember over the years working with various kids from around the town. McGraths, Diskins, Duggins, Stone Sister, Linda Buffton, a whole slew of people that would come and work and pick strawberries for 6 cents a quart, incidentally.
You were one of them.
I was one of them, but I was never particularly gifted at it. I was, I actually sort of allowed myself to, I took precedence of something. I was so clumsy and so slow at it, and had a tendency, my father would become very impatient at how slow I was. And so I basically allowed the situation to evolve so that I would simply walk up and down the aisles and collect the filled baskets from other people who were picking more efficiently. But the strawberries were the main crop. And of course, they were the first crop every year that would sort of put cash into the farmer's pocket after a winter of you know, little income, or certainly little farming income. And then over the years, we would do lettuce and potatoes. I can remember doing parsnips and lots of beets, turnips. More and more over the years, we would do corn. And so I can remember my uncle sort of working out, you know, which fields the corn was going to be in this year, and carefully sort of selecting the hybrid of corn that he was going to use and the period of time that it was going to take to mature, so that, you know, he could actually expect to have one field maturing, weather permitting. He could expect to have, you know, one field of corn, you know, maturing early, and then every couple of weeks, as one sort of passed its prime, another would come in. And so we would pick corn for several weeks in July and August and even into September. And that was done, I say, weather permitting. I mean, if you got tons and tons of rain early on, then everything got slowed down, and all the schedule that you carefully put together was sort of, you know, flummoxed up. But we, in the late 40s, my uncle had had a large water hole excavated, sort of in the center of the land. And after that, if there weren't enough rain, then we would lug pipes out and set them up in rows along the corn rows or whatever crop it happened to be, and we would pump water onto them so that we could, you know, we always managed to have enough water, although it meant a lot more manual labor if it didn't fall out of the sky.
The marketing of the produce, how was that done?
Well, there were two different ways. When I was very young, there were a number of people who were basically sort of farmers' agents. The fellow who I remember most was a fellow by the name of Mike Demotica. Mike drove a Cadillac and had lollipops in the glove compartment, which is the reason why I remember him. And he also had tickets to the Red Sox games, and so once or twice a summer there would be a pair of Red Sox tickets that would come from Mike. And he would basically send around fairly large trucks, and he would pick up and take to market at the old Faneuil Hall Market, when the Faneuil Market was actually a working trade of farmers' market. He would take in the excess that hadn't been bought directly by local retailers.
Like the supermarkets?
Well, I mean, I think that the supermarkets through there, but I mean, no, other farm stands, which basically either had, you know, which there were farm stands that sold all their own produce and were so successful that, you know, what they were selling was always local produce. But like there was a farmer who had a small farm in Kitchituate, and he used to take a great deal of our crops because he could sell more than he produced, and so he would come here at, you know, 8 or 9 on a Saturday or a Sunday morning, and we'd have been up picking corn 6:30 or 7, and he would throw it all onto his truck, and he would take it back and have it at his farm stand, you know, picked today, local, and he would sell it there. So there were a number of local stands like that that would buy directly from my uncle and pick it up here. And then what didn't get cold and sold? I mean, on the days that we had bushels and bushels of corn ready, and it was just more than that market would absorb, then it would go in. But he never sold to even then. You know, I mean, I think the major supermarkets had a different acquisition and distribution chain. So I mean, they would buy from retail. They would buy from this wholesaling process, these brokers basically in Boston, and then take it back out. I can't even remember where that. I used to know where that farmers market moved to. I think it maybe is in Chelsea now.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of it was truck farming, you know.
Oh yeah, I mean it was. I mean, a lot of it was truck farming because I mean we would have several crops at the same time. We never had vast quantities of anything after the asparagus years, and so that was truck farming. That what you produced got trucked to someplace else, either by you or by somebody else, and there it got sold, you know, in a separate market, and they took, in the case of the food brokers in Boston, they would take a cut and give you back the difference. I remember waking up with my uncle in the morning, and he would turn on the radio, and at 6:15 or 6:45 in the morning, one of the radio stations would sort of like read the farmer's report, because all the buying and selling was done in the middle of the night.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, you'd take stuff in at the end of the day, and then buyers would come in the middle of the night, and so the prices from the day before would be available on the radio the next morning, and so they would tell you that, you'd get sort of a range of prices per bushel of this, and snap beans, and all the other different crops, and I can remember, so that they would give you a range of prices, and then they would say if it was really fancy and really top quality, then it would be another 50 cents and it was all the different volumes that stuff was sold in. I don't know where that information is available nowadays, probably online.
So you think it's still done the same way?
Well, I know the brokerage process is still done the same way. I suspect that there's less heavy lifting, and I suspect they use pencils and paper a lot less than they used to.
With strawberries, you said you were picking it for 6 cents a quart. Do you remember what it sold for?
50, I think. I think my uncle got 50 cents a quart. Mm-hmm. We put the quarts in trays of 20. And my sense is that he could get, $10 for a tray. And, when he would net, let's see, 6 times 20, $1.20. So that doesn't sound like the math is right. But anyway, so that was what we were, we were wholesaling it for 50 cents.
And that was during the 50s?
50s, even up to the early 60s, I think. Although what we were selling it for, I think, probably went up faster than what my uncle was willing to pay the people to pick it.
At one time, there were orchards here.
Yeah, and the remnants of the orchards, because I certainly don't remember orchards, but the remnants of the orchard are still visible occasionally along the lines. You'll see an old, gnarled, sort of hopeless-looking apple tree that's managed to survive without apples anymore. Two or three of them, I think, still exists alongside the cart path. As you drive down the cart path, there are a couple where there are large sort of, apple trees twice my age still there.
Interesting.
Yeah, and I always think in terms of apples, because one of the things that I think is really interesting is that people now are doing heritage apples, but my father and his sisters would talk about varieties of apples that I had never heard of, and how wonderful these apples that they remember as children were, and how for one reason or another they simply, weren't grown or weren't available anymore.
Well, now the fourth generation, your son, is coming.
My son.
I guess will be the fifth generation.
Yes, it will. My son Ezra will be coming and moving into this house at 82 Old Bedford Road in the fall. And of course, I'm at 129, so we'll be going into 140 years, I think, of family members on the land. He was, I was actually touched because when I talked with him about the possibility that, you know, that the land would actually be sold, and my son said, well, then it won't be ours anymore. And so the fact that he's shown an interest in being here in my aunt's house is really exciting for me.
That's terrific. Right now you have a farmer from Acton?
Yeah, Eric Eric Nelson, whose father, Alan, in Acton, had the Concubit Farm for a number of years. Eric does, I guess, most of the work now. But Eric has been growing on it for the last 2 or 3 years. Before that, the Amendolia family at Pine Tree Farm used to cultivate and grow mostly corn on it, and of late Eric has been doing it. And as a matter of fact, the arrangement that's been made with the town, I was pretty careful to make sure that the town understood that there was a crop planted on the land already, and that Eric, you know, had title to what was being grown and would harvest it after the title shifts to the town, that Eric's rights to the crop that he's growing would continue in place.
It shifts to the town in July, right?
The planned closing, the planned transfer of title is the 15th of July.
Actually, it was right after the sale of the Amendolia land last year at town meeting, 2004, I guess, that the town approached you?
Yes. Well, it was interesting. I mean, the town approached me actually during the hearings that were being held before the special election, before the special town meeting, about the Amendolia land. Mrs. Rasmussen, who was the planning director, told me that in the past my father had expressed an interest in and a willingness to talk with the town about the land, and so she said that as they were sort of completing the Amendolia acquisition, that she felt it was a good time to begin the conversations with us. And so that's been an interesting process over more than a year of what was it the town wanted and so forth. I think I've said before, and I mentioned in a letter that I wrote to the Journal, that there's been a sense in the family for a long time that we weren't going to farm forever. I mean, my brother and I showed no particular interest in becoming agronomists. And so there's always been the sense that the land might be kept essentially as it's been for many years if the town could purchase it and sort of carry on the process. So the family's very pleased about what's happening.
Thank you.